Welcome to the Educated Patient Podcast. Today we have Dr. Bellini and an associate of MGH Life Sciences. Today's discussion is on type 1 diabetes, and the intention of our conversation today is to just open up what it's like to live with type 1 diabetes and also treat those that are living with type 1 diabetes. Our hope is through storytelling, we'll be able to help those that are living with the condition, but also caretaking and living with loved ones that have it as well. And that's the point of sharing these stories today, is to really just open up awareness around what it's like to have type 1 diabetes. So Dr. Bellini, thank you for joining us. And Brielle, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Doc, I would love to start with you. You have a unique story, I believe, coming to the table here as a provider and somebody that has a lot of experience with type 1 diabetes. So I'd love for you to just frame up the conversation from your experience firsthand with type 1.
Absolutely. So, my name is Natalie Bellini. I'm an assistant professor of medicine at Case Western Reserve University and the program director for diabetes technology at University Hospitals in Cleveland, Ohio, where we follow approximately 100,000 patient lives with diabetes. But I also happen to live with type 1 diabetes, and I've had type 1 for more than 50 years now. I think you hit 50 and you stop counting. And so I do bring in an interesting perspective because I live with it every day. So I think it becomes, when you're working as a person with diabetes, when you're looking at someone and they come in wounded because someone said to them, "What did you eat on Tuesday?" And you're like, "I don't know what I did this morning. I'm not sure how I got here." Right? I'm glad I have two shoes on that match. And you want to know what I did 2 weeks ago? I think that when you feel that way, or you're made to feel guilty or at fault, whether you're the person with diabetes or the caregiver for that person with diabetes, I think that I can bring a unique perspective to go, yeah, sometimes glucose goes up. You know, I hope it went up because you had something delightful and it just wasn't, you know, a fluke of diabetes. So that's typically my perspective.
Great. Thank you. And Brielle, I'd love to introduce you and invite you to the conversation. We were talking offline before we hit record, just on, I'm not sure of the technical terms, but I believe to be late onset, right? With the way type 1 diabetes came into the picture for you. So I'd love for you to introduce yourself and just share a little bit about that story for you as it came on a little bit later in life.
Yeah, of course. So my name is Brielle, and I was diagnosed with type 1 diabetes at the age of 24 through routine blood work. And I feel like this is a unique situation because when I was diagnosed, I was stage 2 type 1 diabetes, and I had an option to delay the onset of stage 3 type 1 diabetes with T-Zield. But at the time, I feel like I didn't have all the information I would have liked to, you know, move forward and make those decisions. I was more in the mindset of like, I want to start treating it because I want to be able to, you know, manage this condition and, you know, safely move forward and figure out a way to, you know, be in the most control as I can be. But in a way, it was also such a blessing because like I found out through routine blood work, so I didn't experience any symptoms at the time. I didn't experience DKA, so, you know, I'm thankful for that. You know, I didn't have any family history, so it was definitely a confusing period of my time figuring out, you know, anything about type 1 diabetes to move forward and, you know, properly fuel and figure out my carb ratios, figure out technology, and also educating the people around me, not just myself.
It sounds like the adjustment period is still recent, right? What are some other kind of rippling factors or impacts that diagnosis at that stage of life had for you? Because I imagine it's more than just navigating the technology and, you know, how your life is going to change day to day, but also like, how does it impact relationships? How does it impact social? How does it impact your mental health? How does it impact the way you think people perceive you at work and all those places?
Yeah, of course. I feel like it's something I kind of need to be transparent about because I feel like for me, it's like the loudest part of my day to day, and it's hard to be quiet about that. And I feel like it's so important to have the people around you, whether that's coworkers, family, friends, aware to some capacity of what's going on in the event of something happening. I know my boss, my family, my friends, they know where I keep my glucagon in the event of an emergency. I think it's important to have those open and honest conversations so that, you know, you try to be as independent as you can managing this condition. But sometimes, you know, you need people around you to be aware of the situation and also, you know, be patient with you. There are times where, you know, you may encounter a situation, whether for me, I'm a long distance runner. So sometimes during a run, my glucose will rapidly drop and I need to treat it. And in that moment, it can be very scary, even though I'm as prepared as I can be to treat it in that moment. It's important to have people around you that also demonstrate that patience so that, you know, you don't get as fearful in those moments. And also just, you know, being able to have those open and honest conversations when, you know, your sugar may be high or may be low, you know, how you may be responding in those moments, and just understanding that, you know, what your next steps are to get yourself back in range.
Mm. Dr. Blini, just to switch gears a little bit, I'm purely coming at this podcast from the lens of being educated myself, which I think will help make this authentic. I'm curious just to hear from you. For those that know little about type 1 diabetes, maybe they're newly diagnosed, right? There's a, how do you explain to somebody who knows very little about what type 1 diabetes actually is?
Great question. So type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. So the body, for unknown reasons still, we have some ideas around it, but there's some genetic risk, there's some other things that happen, environmental triggers, decides on its own volition to attack the beta cells in the pancreas. And that beta cell destruction, beta cells are what make insulin. So if you don't have insulin, glucose can't get out of the blood and into the cells that need it. And that's what causes the hyperglycemia, the high glucose, is that inability or not enough insulin at the time, throughout that destruction. Interesting parts of type 1 diabetes are before 2015, we didn't really understand it. You either had it or you didn't have it, right? People, most of people presented in the ER, in DKA, very, very ill. And it is not unheard of, like Brielle said, that she got diagnosed in routine blood work. She saw they saw glucose is rising. They looked at her and said, you're a long distance runner. We need to do some more tests. And they draw the test and figure out that she has antibodies that are positive. But if we take a step back and look at, so you have some genetic risk to develop type 1. There is some sort of environmental trigger. We know some things that, you know, through research that aren't the trigger. We know it's not cow's milk early in life. We know it's not vaccines. We know it's not, right? There's lots of we know it's not. What we don't know is what it is. And so Epstein-Barr is another option that we are like, but if you went into a room of people that were maybe 20 years old, half of them probably have already had Epstein-Barr at some point, right? So not everyone who gets Epstein-Barr develops type 1. But is that environmental, is that virus combined with the genetic risk? What happens? We don't really know. So you end up with this genetic risk. You end up with an environmental trigger. And stage 1 type 1 is that we can detect those antibodies. And that destruction has started to happen. That beta cell decline has started to happen. But the person is completely asymptomatic. And the only way we can tell is checking those antibodies. And if we check their glucose at any point, even after going to a fast food restaurant and eating a bacon double cheeseburger, large fry, regular soda, and a sundae, their glucose would be fine because there's plenty of beta cells left to continue to make insulin, and the person doesn't know. Stage 2 type 1, which is what Brielle mentioned, is where your beta cell function has continued to fall. You still have some left. And that stage, we start to see glucoses rise with higher carbohydrate meals. And we start to see fasting glucoses rise. The A1C creeps up a little bit, maybe. But we don't see overt symptoms. There's not, you're thirsty, you're tired, you're urinating, those classic symptoms of type 1. stage three type one is what I tell patients. That's what we know and love, right? This is the type one we're used to. Your beta cell function, you still have some, but you've developed the signs and symptoms of diabetes. Polyuria, so excessive urination. Polydipsia, you can't drink enough. And polyphagia, you can't eat enough. Because remember that glucose is now in the blood. It can't get out and feed the cells. Your body is trying to do two things. Feed the cells so you're hungry and urinate out the glucose because the glucose is high in the blood. So those symptoms are from that. There is a suggested stage four type one for those people that have had long-standing type one and there's zero beta cell function left. And those are the stages of type one. Interestingly, like Brielle said, I was diagnosed at the age of 24. And you think, whoa, this is a pediatric disease. What happened? Are you that rare? Actually, it's not rare. 60% of people that get diagnosed with type 1 are diagnosed as adults, so above the age of 20. So it used to be a pediatric disease only. We never knew people that got type 1 as adults. And recently in our practice, we diagnosed someone at 85 with type 1 diabetes. The difference between type 1 and type 2 is those antibodies that we can measure. So we can, you know, if someone comes to say with type 2 that they need insulin, they'll say, well, now do I have type 1 because I need insulin? And the answer is no, you're antibody negative. You do not have type 1 ever. Yours is a different disease altogether.
And is there also a difference in terms of like with type 1, it's autoimmune. And so you very much are going to live with this for the rest of your life, right? And there's stages, I imagine, of type 2, at least from my knowledge, where it could be reversed back, right, with proper treatment and the such.
Exactly. So with type 1 diabetes, there are therapies now to delay the onset to stage 3, right? FDA-approved therapies. And there's a lot of research. We really want people screening because when we know that diabetes is coming, there are therapies we can use to delay the onset. There are also the alternative to that, which is when we get to stage 3, we don't end up in DKA in a hospital, but also there are lots of therapies being looked at for that person that is in stage 3 type 1, newly diagnosed, but what we have is some residual beta cell function. We want that preserved forever. So we would love it if they made a little bit of insulin forever. So there are research studies across the United States and throughout the world. There's a lot going on in Europe as well, to delay that ultimate zero beta cell function left, which is, and what do those look like? Typically, they are therapies that say to the body, stop this immune response, leave it alone. Those beta cells are not your enemy, leave them alone, right? And so we need to know and need to screen in order to know who is going to develop type 1.
Brielle, I'm curious. I know you've done your own research, but how much are you learning right now from Dr. Bellini? Because she's throwing a lot out right now, and I imagine it's also helpful for you as you're—
Absolutely. It's always great when it's like broken out that way, understanding that there's different stages to it as well. It's not just you have type 1 diabetes and now there's, you know, ways to, you know, early detection, determine this earlier on to figure out how you're going to move forward if you're able to delay that onset, because, you know, like we just mentioned, you're going to live with it forever currently. And, you know, that's a whole adjustment. Your day-to-day operations, how you work, your fitness socially, it impacts every decision that you're making. So being able to, you know, delay that onset would make a huge difference, especially, you know, later on in life, earlier in life, at any point of your life, it is so important. And I also like that we had mentioned that it's commonly known as a pediatric condition. And I think that was a confusing part for me when I got diagnosed. I didn't understand that that could still happen because of that, you know, common belief. So that was an interesting part as well, especially when I would share that with people like, oh, I didn't know you were able to still get that.
So that brings up an interesting thought in my head. We mentioned, if we're proactive with it, we can offset or delay, right? So how, like, then the question begs, who should be getting screened? When should we be getting screened? Is it if we have it in our family, like that should trigger us to get screened, or should everybody be getting screened for that matter?
So it's an interesting question because it depends on where you live, right? So in Italy, for example, they are doing population-based screening now. Every child is getting screened between the ages of 2 and 4, 5 and 7, and then 9 and 11. And so recently, literally this week at EASD, the European American Diabetes Association, basically, right? Big meeting, they just came up with guidelines and that said that we should be doing population screening. Why would we do population screening? Because of two reasons. One, even if you have a first degree relative, so that means your brother or your sister or your mom or your dad or your child has type 1, it's a 15-fold increased risk of developing type 1. Okay, so you have a higher risk. The challenge is 90% of people they have no first degree relative. If you have a second degree relative, so let's say I have a cousin with type 1, my risk is still 2-fold. So it definitely is an increased risk. We also see people with other autoimmune diseases like celiac disease or like Hashimoto's, autoimmune thyroid, whether they have hyper or hypothyroid, those people are at an increased risk. But the challenge is the other 90%. And when we know it's coming, we reduce the risk of diabetic ketoacidosis at diagnosis, which is a hospitalization. It's a big illness. It's not just I was in for a few days and I felt better. It actually, the trajectory of getting diagnosed that way is horrible. DKA is deadly. From about 62% of people are diagnosed in DKA down to about 3 to 6%. Because if we know it's coming, even if we choose not to, like Brielle decided not to use the teplizumab, which is FDA approved to delay her onset. She knew it was coming, right? And so she could watch herself, check her glucoses, decide if she's going to wear a CGM, get engaged in endocrine care, and really work towards what do I need to do, how do I need to do it? Very different from not. But the guidelines are continuing to change. So ADA guidelines in 2025 say all first degree relatives should be screened, period. Are we doing that in the United States? Not yet. We're not even close. I have a dot phrase through Epic. We use Epic at our hospital system that says, you know, you have type 1 diabetes. Your children should be screened. Your brothers and sisters, your mom and your dad. And the challenge is, I work in Cleveland and someone will look at me and say, well, my sister lives in New Jersey and my brother lives in Arkansas. So in adult care, it's very difficult to get the siblings to do the work to get it done, right? The other challenge with screening is I have a mom with type 1 and I say, hey, you should screen your children. Your kids are of age for screening. This is what we should do. And there's a real hesitation because living with type 1 is very, very difficult. You have one, bad low blood sugar where your heart is racing or someone's seen you have a seizure because you didn't get great care in the beginning or you were a kid and you had a seizure on an athletic field because insulin wasn't great back then and all the different things, right? You've struggled at work. You've had a meeting and you can't even speak a full sentence. Those things happen to people with type 1. And they think to themselves, I can't have a child with this. I can't do this to a child. So they don't screen, even if it's there, right? The background is there. And so it's a very hard lever to pull for some people. Our kids were screened. Our kids are adults now. But they were part of a trial before. There are a couple of trials for screening right now. And before the major trial that's happening now, there was a previous trial called the Diabetes Prevention Trial 1, DPT-1, and our kids were screened. But I'm a scientist, and I wanted to know. And I told my kids, look, you're sticking out your arm. You can have ice cream when we're done. This is for science. And we didn't know anything. We didn't know the stages. Our kids helped create those stages, right? The previous trials. And I think when we look at type 1 diabetes and the families that go do the breakthrough walks and they do this and they do that, I'm like, I need you to stick out your arm and give us some blood so we can figure out who's going to get this. I need you to help us help the other people, right? So that we can figure out how to prevent this. This is an autoimmune disease and we're figuring out how to prevent other autoimmune diseases. We need your help to do this too, not just by doing a walk, not just by raising money, because truth be known, we're not filling the studies. We're getting better at screening, but we're not doing a great job yet. And I think with this new guidelines to say we should be doing population screening, hopefully in the next couple of years, it will change.
Great. To to bring us to closure, I feel like we could talk for hours about this topic. Brielle, I'm curious, from your experience as a patient, what's the biggest lesson or biggest thing that you've learned or adjusted to since being diagnosed?
Yeah, I feel like every day I'm learning something new and something I can try to help, you know, manage this condition the best I can. But most importantly, it's taught me to be patient with myself and appreciate what my body is capable of doing physically and mentally. You know, it's easy to get frustrated with the constant demand of our blood sugars, whether that's at work, exercising. You know, it's this constant noise that we're hearing and, you know, needing to respond to or look at to, you know, make sure we're staying in a safe, healthy range throughout the day and also just feel our best. So, you know, it's taught me to listen and prioritize what my body needs in the moment and just celebrating those small victories because, you know, it's a testament of like what my mind and body can accomplish, like in the face of different challenges and your body changing.
Love that. Dr. Bellini, I don't know if we talked about this yet, but Brielle is running the New York City Marathon. And Brielle, I believe you're raising money for type 1 diabetes. Is that correct?
Correct. For the organization Beyond Type 1.
Great. That is a big victory, right? But I that was one of the reasons that inspired us to invite you on today as an associate at MGH is to just tie in the fact that we do have individuals. The company is large enough where the data will tell us that there's multiple individuals inside of a company of that size that have type 1 diabetes, and to highlight your story and just share that what you said earlier, right? It's we need to talk about this. People around us need to know what you're dealing with so that we could better support you and also make you feel like you're not odd because you have a diagnosis of type 1 diabetes, right? Thank you, Brielle. Dr. Bellini, as a scientist and somebody that's lived with this for a really long time, I'm super curious to know what you are most excited about in this particular realm, whether that be technology or advancements. We already talked at length on future rollout of new guidelines, but beyond that, I'm curious what you're excited about in advancements in this realm.
Wow. So there's so many things. I mean, the technology is changing every day, right? So new insulin pumps, new continuous glucose sensors that talk to each other that help people like Brielle be able to run a marathon, you know, to do it without having to eat glucose every five, you know, minute. You know, we used to have to feed people through the marathon. And obviously we're still giving calories to someone, but we should be able to do it differently and better. And we are now. And Brielle is running for an organization that we use as a resource all the time. I pull it up. It's on my favorites and I open it up for patients and cut and paste it into there. They offer amazing education and support for people with type 1. We love Beyond Type 1 at our practice. I'm also, though, excited about using other therapies. And you guys at MGH cover other therapies for people, you know, for people with type 2. And we are now blending the two together and using some therapies. There's really great data on the use of glucagon-like peptides, GLP-1s and GLP-GIPs. Like semaglutide and tirzepatide, we are giving some people metformin even, right? Other therapies that we're using SGLT2 inhibitors, sodium glucose cotransporter inhibitors in people with type 1 to increase their time in range, reduce their risks of complications. And it's a difficult disease to have. No one wakes up and says, this is going to be the greatest diabetes day ever. I can't wait to have diabetes today. With that being said, we are working really hard in research and in clinical practice to improve those lives so that you can, you know, raise your children, pay a mortgage, run a marathon, travel the world, and do what you really want to do with type 1 diabetes.
I love that. I appreciate both of your insights today and your stories. And I know this won't be the last conversation we have around type 1 diabetes, especially as it's continuing to become more and more of a topic of awareness for patients out there. So for those that are listening, if you if this conversation resonated with you and you're craving more information on type 1 diabetes, we've already mentioned Beyond Type 1 Diabetes as a source that both Brielle and Dr. Bellini love to reference. So check out Beyond Type 1 Diabetes and also check out the Educated Patient website. We're continuing to fill the Educated Patient with resources and conversations just like this that help you make better decisions and improve the outcomes of you if you're a patient, but also of your family members and loved ones. So thank you, Dr. Bellini, and thank you, Brielle.